So there's small group leaders' notes are down there if anybody wants to pick them up afterwards. It would be great if you had a Bible in front of you. So this morning we're going to be looking at John 18, so John's Gospel, continuing our series there. We're going to be working through the first 11 verses of John 18. So I'll let people give out the Bibles there as for a minute. So it's Palm Sunday today, and to be honest, I find Palm Sunday a bit puzzling. I wonder if you do too. One minute, Jesus enters Jerusalem on a donkey to the sound of cheering crowds. The next, those same crowds are jeering and calling for his torture and crucifixion. I know public opinion is notoriously fickle. Just look at the recent experience of England's rugby team and Eddie Jones. Hero to zero in three short weeks. Yet the popularity swing in Jerusalem seems something special, even by our own standards, and even without Facebook. The puzzle is why? How come Jerusalem public opinion swung so violently within only a few days? Perhaps part of the explanation is that there was a mismatch or disconnect between what the crowd wanted Jesus to do and to be and what the reality of who Jesus was and what he came to do. The crowd wanted Jesus to be one thing, a political messiah, here to drive out the Roman superpower and establish Jewish rule in Jerusalem. The problem was that Jesus had other concerns and an entirely different agenda. He would indeed inaugurate a new kingdom, a new order no less, but a kingdom not of this world, as he would later tell Pontius Pilate. The disconnect between the crowd's desire for a political Messiah and the reality of Jesus' mission was total, and the resulting disappointment lightly severe. Yet a disconnect between what we want from Jesus and what he really is about is not just the preserve of the Palm Sunday crowd. It's a danger for you and me. If sinful humanity, you and me included, are good at anything, we are good at building our own idols. That is, our own ideas and preconceptions about God in place of the reality. Perhaps we want good moral teaching, and so our focus is on Jesus the teacher, the underwriter of traditional values. Perhaps we want health and relief from sickness, and so focus on Jesus the healer. Perhaps we want contentment, even success in life, and we want Jesus the fixer. Perhaps we want spirituality and some depth and meaning, some relief from the drab modern world. And so we seek Jesus the guru. I'm sure you can add your own versions to the list. Now, don't hear me wrong. I'm not suggesting that any of these needs and desires are inappropriate or that Jesus does not, in the end, meet them to some degree. That's not my point. What I want to highlight is the danger of you and I becoming so focused on our own agendas, our own needs and desires, that we entirely miss out who Jesus really is and what he actually came to do. If you and I don't reckon with that reality, then we risk the same disconnect, the mismatch, but as the Palm Sunday crowd, and perhaps the same disappointment in the end. So, to see the reality of Jesus' mission, You and I need the Christian equivalent of a trip to Specsavers. Thankfully, and of all the Gospels, that's precisely what John attempts to give us in his account. He has written so that you and I may believe into Jesus. That's chapter 20, verse 31. He tells us why he writes his gospel. And for John, that means more than blind faith, a stab in the dark. John's ultimate goal in writing is for us to enter with him. He's the beloved disciple, into real friendship with Jesus, proper friendship, where the reality of Jesus' heart and character and priorities are open and understood. You will recall the upper room discourse in chapter 15, verse 15, which we looked at several weeks ago in particular. Jesus seeks the love and fellowship of friends, not just the respect of blind servants. And so this morning we arrive at chapter 18 and the Garden of Gethsemane. Our passage marks the beginning of John's account of Jesus' passion. That's chapters 18 and 19, a great thing to read. And something that you and I will want to reflect on this Easter week. John has been building his story carefully up to this point, repeating and developing great themes, preparing us, his readers, for the events to come in chapters 18 and 19. And in our passage this morning, John sets out what I'm going to call three interpretive lenses, three sets of Specsavers glasses, if you will. And these glasses can help you and I grasp the reality and significance of Jesus' mission, his passion. My prayer is that John's three sets of glasses will help shape and deepen our reflections on the passion through the course of Easter week. So to see the first set of glasses, we pick up the story in chapter 18, verse 1. Turn there with me now. When Jesus had finished praying, Jesus left, or literally went forth. Jesus and the disciples had been in the upper room, and Jesus had just finished his great high priestly prayer. Now Jesus leads his disciples outside and down the hill from Jerusalem. They go into the Kidron Valley, which separates the main city from the Mount of Olives, and then Jesus takes the disciples on up the other side of the valley into a garden. Jesus and his disciples seem to have frequented the garden, verse 2. Perhaps it was their usual refuge, away or meeting place away from the hustle and bustle of city life. Jerusalem would have been packed, heaving with visitors during a busy Passover. You can actually see, it's interesting, if you go to Jerusalem, you can actually see olive groves right at this point, this place on the Mount of Olives right now, nearby where Jesus must have taken the disciples that night. But trouble brews, verse 3. Judas, the traitor, arrives, leading a posse. John's language suggests a sizable number, perhaps over 100 people. There were Roman soldiers, temple guards, and Pharisees, the lay leaders of the people. Let's see, I think I have a picture. A coalition of infamy, if ever there was one. Now, the presence of Roman soldiers is unique to John, but no great surprise. The Jewish leaders had probably prearranged Jesus' arrest with the Romans, who would have been very keen to avoid any disturbance during a busy Passover feast. So Judas's posse had come prepared for trouble. They had lights, the text tells us, for the garden would have been dark and would have offered plenty of places to hide, and they had weapons. The posse would have been seen from a long way off. And at this point, Jesus gives us a brief glimpse into the mind of Jesus, or John gives us a brief glimpse into the mind of Jesus. Verse 4. We're told that Jesus knows all that was going to happen to him. In other words, Jesus would have seen the coming posse and known why they had come. He knew that he would soon be arrested and taken to the high priest and from there on to Pontius Pilate. He knew that the Jerusalem crowd would ultimately reject him. He knew that crucifixion was coming. Indeed, if you've read through John's gospel, you will know that Jesus constantly talked about his hour. In the first half of the gospel, Jesus would say that his hour had not come. That's what he says to his mother in chapter 2, to his brothers at the start of chapter 7, and yet again at the end of chapter 7, when temple guards come and try and seize him. Palm Sunday actually marks the change. Immediately after the triumphal entry, the passage that we had read earlier in the service, Jesus changes tack and declares that his hour had now come. The rest of chapter 12 in John explains, the moment of death had arrived. You see, John has been preparing you and me, the reader, for chapter 18, verse 4, and the confrontation between Jesus and the soldiers. As readers, we can look ahead to the unfolding events, the trials and the crucifixion and the rest of chapters 18 and 19. But at this point, what John wants us to know is that Jesus likewise knew full well the end of the story. And yet, verse 4, Jesus still went forth. He doesn't run for cover or slink back into the darkness of the garden. He is the one who takes the initiative and goes forth to meet Judas and the soldiers head on. The went out of verse 4 is the same verb in the original Greek as the went forth in verse 1. It is a verb of command, Jesus inexorably moving towards his long anticipated hour. Now, I wonder if you've spotted the difference between John's account of the Garden of Gethsemane and the accounts in the Synoptic Gospels, that is Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In the Synoptics, Jesus is troubled and sorrowful in the Garden of Gethsemane. He famously prays in anguish for the cup to pass. In contrast, John does not focus on Jesus' internal struggle in the garden at all. He had already done that back in chapter 12. Instead, John presents Jesus here in chapter 18 as the one always in control, taking initiative. It was Jesus that took the disciples to the garden in verse 1, and it was Jesus who confronted Judas and the soldiers in verse 4. So what, you might well ask? What's John's distinctive point? I think John gives us the answer down in verses 8 and 9. And the answer turns out to be the first of our three sets of interpretive glasses for the Passion. Scan your eye down. After identifying himself, Jesus tells the soldiers to let the disciples go. And then John adds the comment, the explanation. This happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled. I have not lost one of those you gave me. Jesus knows very well what's coming, yet he takes the initiative and confronts the soldiers, but on one condition, that his disciples go free. That's what he had early promised to them, and that's what he will now deliver in the garden. And so as we reflect on Jesus' passion, we do not see a passive victim at the mercy of inhumane religious and political authorities, nor do we see a failed teacher or prophet killed for offending Jewish sensibilities. Nor indeed do we see a failed political leader come face to face with the brute reality of Roman power. No, we see a man in full knowledge of the cost taking the initiative to save his friends. Ultimately, Jesus' life was not for the soldiers or the religious authorities or even for the Romans to seize or to take, as if they had any power over him. Others had tried to seize Jesus or stone him earlier in John's gospel and had failed every time. Jesus' life was his own to lay down, and Jesus will lay it down only on the condition that his friends go free. In the garden, that meant his immediate disciples. In the end, that extends to you and me as believers in their message. And so John's account of the Passion carries us to chapter 19, verse 30, and Jesus' cry from the cross, "It is finished." What, you might ask, has Jesus finished? Nothing less than the work of setting free his friends. Having completed this task, the one he set himself, Jesus bowed his head and gave up his spirit. Chapter 19, verse 30. Now, you know you're getting older when you need more than one set of glasses. There's one for reading, another for driving, and another for watching TV. You might even need varifocals. Likewise, the Passion is too rich and multi-layered for just one interpretive lens. The first set of glasses shows us a man taking the initiative to save his friends. To help us grasp a further layer of reality, John develops a second set of interpretive glasses in the identification of Jesus by the soldiers. Turn with me back to verse 4. Jesus takes the initiative and asks the soldiers, "Whom do you seek?" And they respond, "Jesus of Nazareth." To which Jesus straightforwardly identifies himself. "I am he," he says. Now, the interesting thing to note is the repetition in the next few verses. John's a preacher, and like many a good preacher, he uses repetition to make a point. I'm sure you've heard the advice to all aspiring preachers. Say what you're going to say, say it, say what you've said. So look down at verse 6. John repeats Jesus' answer, "I am he," and then tells us that the answer startled the soldiers, causing them to fall to the ground. Then for good measure, verses 7 and 8, repeat the interaction between Jesus and the soldiers another time. John has Jesus' answer in verse 8, "I told you," and then we have the third instance of, "I am he." I hope you'll agree. Three times "I am he" in as many verses is enough to suggest that something important is going on here. Now, the phrase "I am he" or "I am" occurs elsewhere in John and carries with it important theological freight. On the screen, I'll give you a summary. Let's see if I press this. Yeah, I give you a summary of where the "I am" phrase occurs. And to get technical, I'm afraid, for just a minute, there are a total of seven great "I am" sayings in John, that is, "I am" sayings with what the grammar experts among us would call a predicate. In other words, "I am" followed by an image. Perhaps you know the images by heart. Jesus is the bread of life, the light of the world, the good shepherd, the resurrection and the life, the way, the truth, and the true vine. With the three times repetition of "I am" or "I am he," John surely wants you and me to go back and to recall these earlier images from his gospel. We are to bring these earlier images to mind as we read about Jesus' arrest and passion. The very one who brings sustenance to the starving, the one who lights up our darkness, the one who cares for God's sheep, the one who grants a life that carries on through death, the one who is the way to heaven, the one who is truth itself, and the one who embodies the true people of God. This is the one who is being arrested and who will die rejected on the cross. What? The bread, the light, the life, the truth on the cross of a criminal? Surely not. But there's even more to the three I ams than that. Jesus also used the phrase, I am he, a number of times in John's gospel without any predicate at all. That is, the I am he appears on its own, just like in chapter 18, without any following image. I've listed these instances on this slide. For example, the woman at the well in John chapter 4 talked about a coming Messiah, to which Jesus said literally, I am he, the one speaking to you. And then when walking on the water, Jesus says to his disciples, I am he, rendered in our translations as it is I. And then again at the temple, where Jesus made the stunning claim to have pre-existed even the patriarch Abraham. Before Abraham was, Jesus says, I am he. I'm sure, as good Bible readers, you have already picked up where all this is heading. I am, or the phrase, I am he, was, of course, the name that God gave himself in the Old Testament. Literally, Yahweh in the original Hebrew, translated ego eimi in the Greek, which is the original in John, and then now rendered I am, or I am he, in the English translations. This was the unique name of God spoken to Moses at the burning bush, the name of God known only to Israel. And here is John invoking that very name on the lips of Jesus at the moment of his arrest. Not just once, but three times so that we get it. It seems John wants you and me to grasp the true identity of the man in the garden. The man about to be arrested, tried, and ultimately crucified. The man who will seem all too human, weak, helpless, even naked. And as we see and listen to all that's going to happen to him, we will be tempted to think of Jesus only as a normal man. Yet John wants us to see past the human weakness to the divine reality. Jesus may have laid aside his majesty and at this moment permitted himself to be arrested and crucified. But one thing Jesus will not lay down is his divinity. He remains what he always and forever was and is, the only begotten Son of the Father, the divine Word that brings life to every person, the great I am. The soldiers hear the famous name and fall back, verse 6. So they should. This is John's second set of glasses, and they are truly revolutionary. They turn conventional human thinking about God on its head. When talking about God, his character and glory, we normally think of words like might and power and strength and honor. We naturally conceive of God as bigger and better and stronger and larger than anything human. Yet Jesus reveals his true divine character and glory in the passion. And it is not what any of us would have anticipated. Jesus' divine character and glory are not to do with might or power or strength, as if might or power or strength automatically made right. They do not. On the contrary, the divine glory is actually Jesus' willingness to go as far as laying down his own life for the good of his creatures, you and me. Human history is marred by the deeds of grotesque and fundamentally unglorious strongmen who are out for no one but themselves or their cronies. Yet thankfully, above the pain of human history, the cross reveals the countercultural glory of God, a God who rules not for his own benefit, but in and through self-emptying love for his creatures. Jesus rules history from a cross. And if the cross is indeed Jesus' divine glory, then the challenge is for you and me in the church to get with the program. So often, our concerns follow the pattern of the world. For position or influence or attention, self-ambition, even our own glory and pleasure. Yet we are called to better and to hire. You and I are to wash one another's feet, chapter 12 in John, and to prefer the needs of others before our own. Why? Not because we are just nice, but because when you and I serve and sacrifice one another, it is then and only then that we start to resemble the divine character and glory of Jesus the I Am. I wonder if you and I are ready for John's second set of glasses. Peter wasn't, at least not yet. He can't imagine that Jesus, his friend and his Lord, would be arrested and killed for him. So in true Peter style, he goes all action hero on us. A first century Jason Bourne, if you like. The soldiers may have easily outnumbered him, but Peter is not going to go down without a fight. He draws a sword and he swipes. The unfortunate Malchus loses an ear. Verse 10. Now, as I was preparing this sermon, one question has been nagging me. From where did Peter get the sword? Did he have it under his cloak? And if so, had he been carrying it since he had left the upper room earlier in the evening? Had he even had a sword with him in the upper room and during the Last Supper? Did Peter always carry around a sword? Or did Peter just steal the sword off a soldier in the garden? Perhaps, but that would have been pretty impressive. The text doesn't tell us. So then I turned and read a number of commentaries to find an answer and was disappointed to find that nobody ever discussed the issue. So if anybody has an answer, I'd be very glad to hear it. In any event, well-intentioned and brave though Peter's action hero persona may have been, it gets short shrift from Jesus. He turns to Peter and commands him to put away the sword. Jesus then declares the phrase that gives us our third set of interpretive glasses for the Passion. Verse 11, "Shall I not drink the cup the Father has prepared for me?" The cup is, of course, the cup of God's righteous anger or wrath. Psalm 75, verse 8 says that in the hand of the Lord is a cup full of foaming wine mixed with spices. He pours it out and all the wicked of the earth drink it down to its very dregs. Other Old Testament texts also mention the cup. You see, God the Father is rightly angry. Sinful humanity has rebelled against his good rule, rejected him, and in so doing has polluted God's good creation. Not just filling the sea with plastic, but also filling human history with conflict, hate, exploitation, and of course, the resulting suffering. You and I too are implicated. We take the gifts of God and too often reject the giver, living our own way without due care for others or reference to God, our maker and sustainer. Now, we would be in trouble if the cup of God's righteous wrath was ours to drink. Thankfully, the verse 11 quote has a second aspect. Jesus says, "Shall I not drink the cup the Father has prepared for me?" The emphasis is on the I and the me. In spite of Peter's best action hero persona or impersonation, the cup of wrath was never Peter's to drink in the first place. He must therefore put the sword down and get out of the way. Neither is the cup ours to drink. None of us are a Messiah. The Father has mysteriously reserved the cup of wrath only for Jesus. And Jesus will drink it to its dregs. The one with living water for the woman at the well, chapter 4, will ultimately cry out, "I am thirsty," on the cross. Often, you and I find it natural to identify and worship Jesus the Son. He gave everything for us. But we can have much more trouble identifying with God the Father. We may sometimes conceive of the Father as the great fault finder or CCTV in the sky, looking down on every moment of our lives and seeking to pick us up whenever we inevitably step out of line. We can think of him as judgmental, disapproving, angry even, and so struggle to trust him and to pray. Well, verse 11 teaches us otherwise. You see, the Father may be right to be angry about the state of his world and the suffering in it. It is indeed a mess. But mysteriously, the Father will not direct that righteous anger where it is most deserved, sinful humanity. The cup is never meant for Peter nor for us. Instead, God the Father will give the cup of his wrath only to God the Son. Now, not as some weird act of divine child abuse, but as the glorious act of self-giving from the Father to a broken world, to you and to me. The Father is determined to bless his creation, bless you and me despite our sin and despite the cost to himself. If the glory of God the Son is to lay down his life for his friends, the Son only does so because he has already seen the Father doing the same. Chapter 5 in John's Gospel, verse 19. The glory of the Father, then, is his willingness to send his Son in the first place, his only begotten, beloved Son, and to give him for a world of human rebellion and sin. That is John's third set of glasses in chapter 18. For God the Father so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him shall not die, but have eternal life. So, Have you yet acquired the three sets of John's spectacles? A man taking initiative to save his friends, the great I am displaying his true glory, the Father's love for a rebellious world. We all need reminding of these glasses. And my challenge to you and to me this Easter week is to reread John's gospel from start to finish. Never was there a man or a God like Jesus. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. And out of his fullness, we have all received grace upon grace. If the band would like to come back now, let us stand and worship and thank that God who gave himself for us.